This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. My guest, Jeff Bridges, can't remember the first time he was on a movie set, literally. He wasn't yet 2 years old when he appeared in the 1951 film The Company She Keeps with his mom, Dorothy Dean Bridges. Jeff Bridges and his brother Beau grew up in show business. They sometimes appeared in the TV series Sea Hunt as kids, which starred their father, Lloyd Bridges. Jeff Bridges got his first Oscar nomination at the age of 22 for his role in the 1971 film The Last Picture Show. He's earned five more since and finally won the Best Actor Oscar for the 2009 film Crazy Heart. Among his other films are Heaven's Gate, Starman, Jagged Edge, The Fabulous Baker Boys, The Big Lebowski, and True Grit. He's generating Oscar buzz again for his role in the modern Western Hell or High Water and has already earned a Golden Globe nomination for his performance. The film also stars Ben Foster and Chris Pine as two brothers who are robbing small-town branches of a bank in West Texas. Bridges plays an aging Texas Ranger investigating the crimes. In this scene, he's speaking with a witness, then other investigators after one of the robberies.
I know their faces was covered, but could you tell their race? I'm black, white.
Their skin or their souls?
Let's leave their souls out of this for now.
White. From around here, somewhere is my guess, you know, from their voices.
Uh-huh.
Young County says same deal with the branch and Olney.
Excuse me. Do they have video?
Same deal all the way around.
Doesn't Walmart sell all sorts of electronic equipment? My word, get your hands off that. Oh, these boys, they aren't done yet, I'll tell you that.
How come?
Well, they're patient. They're just sticking to the drawers, not taking the hundreds. That's the bank's money. We can trace that. They're trying to raise a certain amount, that's my guess. It's going to take a few banks to get there.
Well, Jeff Bridges, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about this character, Marcus, this Texas Ranger, and how you got him.
Well, this fellow, this Texas Ranger I'm playing, Marcus, in this movie, he's going through the pain of retirement, something that actors, you know, we can act on our deathbeds, you know, so it's something that I had to do a little research about that. Fortunately, Taylor Sheridan, the writer of Hell or High Water, really knew what he was talking about. His cousin, Parnell McNamara, was a marshal, but he had to go through retirement, and it was very helpful for me to be able to talk to him and find out what that was all about. And also, we were fortunate to have on the set for many days Joaquin Jackson, who was a very notable Texas Ranger. You know, he's written several books. He's he was just so wonderful to have him on set, not only to tell us, you know, how, you know, what our uniform should look like, how Texas Rangers behave and all that, but just to have him in the room and pick up the, you know, his vibes and to have his support and his blessing was really important.
Yeah, were there any gestures or movements or turns of phrase or inflections that you picked up from him?
You know, I remember he had a, when he took his hat off, he'd like to put it on his boot. That's something I kind of ripped off from him.
One of the fun things about the film is your relationship with your partner, Alberto, who is played by Gil Birmingham. This character is half Mexican-American, half Comanche. You want to just talk a little bit about that? It's a friendship with an edge, isn't it?
Yeah, they're dear friends. But Marcus teases him terribly throughout the film with racial slurs and so forth. One of the first things I do when I'm preparing for a part is I kind of look inside myself and see are there any aspects of myself that might be handy in portraying this character. And my grandfather, Fred Simpson, was a terrible teaser, and my brother Beau, he inherited that teasing gene, used to really tease me, you know, in an awful way. and, you know, get me in crying and stuff. And my mom would say, oh, that's just because he loves you so much, you know. And I, you know, I realized that that was probably true, you know, that it was an expression of intimacy. You know, I know exactly what buttons to push to get a, you know, a rise out of you. That's how much I love you, or how much, that's how well I know you. So that was something I could kind of tap into and plan the role.
I wanted to talk about the last picture show, because it's fascinating to me that this you did when you were, what, 22 years old, right? This is the story of another film set in that same flat West Texas countryside about a small dying town, kind of a dying way of life in a way.
Yeah.
And it's centered in part on some high school kids. I thought we'd listen to a scene. You played Dwayne Jackson, who was a football player, dated the rich girl, the pretty girl in town, JC. And the scene we will hear is later in the film when the two of you have broken up and you've graduated from high school. You're coming back to town after working in the fields, oil fields. And here you've heard that your best friend, Sonny, who's played by Timothy Bottoms, has been dating JC. And so you have this little conversation. Your character, Dwayne, speaks first. Let's listen.
Seen old Leroy last week. Said he thought you and JC had been going together a little.
Yeah, we have, little. She's been kind of bored, so once in a while we go out and eat Mexican food or something.
Well, I hear that ain't all you've been eating.
Well, whoever told you that don't know what he's talking about. Sure, I've been going with her. Why not?
I never said I blame you for it. I don't blame you much. I thought you'd do me that way. I thought we were still best friends.
We are. What you so mad for? I never done nothing to you.
Well, I guess my girl ain't nothing to you.
I ain't her.
Hell, you ain't.
Well, I ain't. She's not your girl anymore.
She is my girl. I don't care. We did break up.
You don't even live here anymore.
I don't make no difference. I always live here. I'm getting her back. I'm telling you right now. She's going to marry me one of these days when I get a little bit more money.
Why, she won't marry
you. Sure she will. We always meant to get married.
She's going off to college soon. I doubt I'll ever get to go with her again myself when she gets off. Yeah, I never saw what it could hurt to go with her this summer, though. She's never going to marry you.
She is, by God. Don't you tell me she won't.
And that's our guest, Jeff Bridges, with Timothy Bottoms in The Last Picture Show, directed by Peter Bogdanovich, a 1971 film. Boy, that's going back to the early days of your career. Not the earliest, but some early days.
Yeah.
You were nominated for an Oscar for that role. And as you look back, I mean, you've had so much experience doing so many roles, and I'm sure your techniques and preparation have evolved over the years. I'm wondering kind of what you hear when you listen to that performance.
Well, it brings back the time, certainly. One of the things, if I, you know, listen to or watch movies, listen to things like that, it's almost like watching a home movie or, you know, listening to a past experience that you had. And I'm, you know, remembering Tim, you know, who's such a, you know, wonderful actor. And I can remember shooting that scene, going around that car. It all happened in around a car. And me cracking a beer bottle over and him putting his eye out and all of that. And also, I'm hearing Larry McMurtry's wonderful dialogue. It's always a pleasure to speak his words.
Did you immerse in that life at all, the life of a small Texas town?
Oh, yeah. Not only the small Texas town itself, but our own little kind of town that we created. You know, those were some, you know, Ellen Burstyn and Cloris Leachman, Ben Johnson, wonderful actors, you know. So hanging out with those guys, Eileen Brennan, we had a wonderful time making that film. And we knew, even though we were all pretty green at that time, we all knew we were involved in something very special.
You could tell then, huh?
Yeah, that movie to me kind of just sits by itself. You know, there's no movies like it, and it's not like any movie. It was shot in black and white when movies were in color. You had Peter Bogdanovich, I think it was his second film.
Right.
And he was a big fan of Ford and Hawks and those guys. So that sensibility is in there that really wasn't in fashion at the time.
Well, The Last Picture Show, that's not the oldest clip that we have. I want to play a scene here of, and we'll talk about it afterwards, a scene of a kid and his dad on a scuba diving boat. And the kid's gotten into some mischief on a dive. Let's listen.
Oh, my God.
Kelly, if you've got something to say now, say it. They didn't get all the dynamite out. There's still some there.
Where?
Where we were diving, there was a buoy with a sign that said A-Zone on it.
Why didn't you say this before?
I was afraid. I promised.
Promised who?
Joey.
Pete, head for that A-Zone buoy.
A little taste of our guest Jeff Fridges as, what were you, 8 or 9 then?
That's wild.
Acting with your dad, Lloyd Bridges, in the series Sea Hunt, which I remember watching. Your dad played Mike Nelson, this diver who went around rescuing people and besting criminals and all. You learned a lot from your dad. I read that you'd sit on the bed and he would talk to you about teaching you the basics of acting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he... You know, especially with Sea Hunt, he'd get me on the bed there, you know, and teach me how to, you know, make it feel like it's happening for the first time, and not to just, you know, wait for him to stop speaking and then I'd do my line. He says, you got to listen to what the other guy's saying and let that, you know, have some effect on what you're going to say. And now go out of the room, now come back in and do a completely a different version of, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. Later on, I got to work with him as an adult. We did a movie called Tucker together and also Blown Away. Mm-hmm. And that was a wonderful experience. And I learned probably the most important thing I ever learned from him on those movies. And that was the way he generally approached the work, which was with such joy. He enjoyed what he was doing so much. And he was... You know, really wanted all his kids to go into acting because he loved it so much.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because some kids whose parents push them into show business, it doesn't always make for the happiest relationships or our happiest lives. And I'm picturing you on that bed thinking, oh, Dad, come on, I want to go out and play ball. No, but you liked it. It was fun.
Well, it's sort of, but, you know, like most kids at age, you don't want to do what your parents want you to do. You know, you get your own ideas. And I certainly had a pile of them, you know. I wanted to, you know, get into music and, you know, painting. And I had a lot of different interests. And my father said, oh, Jeff, don't be ridiculous. You know, that's the wonderful thing about acting is you get to incorporate all of your interests in your parts and you'll get to, you know, do some music and all of that. It'll facilitate that stuff. And he was right. I'm glad I listened to him. But I resisted going into acting for quite a while, as a matter of fact. Long after Picture Show, I was still considering, hey, do I really want to do this for the rest of my life, you know, as my main focus of my professional life, you know.
You know, you come from a family of actors, and your brother, Bo, of course, also had a career. You guys appeared in some films together, Fabulous Baker Boys. What's it been like to have a brother who's a successful actor, too?
Yeah, well, right along with my dad, my brother, Bo, was my teacher. He taught me so much about acting. One of the challenges for, you know, actors starting out is where do you perform? And Bo, and this is, I must have been, you know, 16 years old, he came up with this great idea of renting a flatbed truck, and we would pull into a supermarket, and our father, Lloyd, taught us how to stage fight, you know, fake fight, and we would stage this fake fight. And crowd would, you know, gather around in the parking lot and watching these two guys go at each other. And then we'd say, you know, break our fight up. And we'd say, no, we're putting on a show. And we'd jump on the back of the flatbed truck and perform our scenes that we'd worked on until the police came. And then they would be very upset because we would try to do an improv with them and try to bring them into our show. And they were really started to get serious. We'd say, no, we're leaving. And we'd get back into the truck and we'd go to the next supermarket. And we played the supermarket circuit that way. But Bo, you know, helped me with getting an agent and, you know, all of that. And then working with him in Fabulous Baker Boys. Oh, that was just a dream come true, you know.
And you guys had a fight in that, didn't you?
Oh, we had a terrible fight. Yeah, we had a fight. We were so thrilled from the story that I just told you. That we were going to have this fight, and Steve Clovis, it was his first movie, director, and we asked Steve if we could gaff this fight. And he said, sure, yeah. So we had it all arranged, but we forgot a very important element, which was a safe word, a word that would say, no, you're really hurting me. Stop doing what you're doing. And so at the climax of the fight, my character grabs my brother's hand. He's a piano player. And I proceed to bend his fingers back. And Bo's saying, stop, you're hurting me. And I'm thinking in my mind, yeah, act your ass off, man. And I sent him to the hospital. He hurt his fingers terribly. So you must have a safe word, people.
Jeff Bridges stars with Ben Foster and Chris Pine in the film Hell or High Water. We'll hear more about Jeff Bridges' life and films, including his turn as the dude in the Coen brothers' film The Big Lebowski, after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with actor Jeff Bridges. He stars with Ben Foster and Chris Pine in the modern Western Hell or High Water. He's earned 6 Oscar nominations and won the Best Actor Award for his role in the film Crazy Heart. We have to talk about The Big Lebowski, the film that you made with the Coen brothers, 1998. And let's start with a classic scene from the film. You play this, I guess what we'd call an aging stoner, Jeff Lebowski, but a guy who's known to all of his friends as the dude. And we'll listen to a scene early in the film. And what's happened is that a couple of tough guys broke into your apartment looking for money they said you owed. It turned out they were confusing you with another guy named Jeff Lebowski, who's a rich guy. But before these tough guys left, one of them peed on the rug in your living room. And in the scene we're going to hear, you've come to see the rich Lebowski to ask him to cover the damage. And Mr. Lebowski, who is played by David Huddleston, speaks first. Let's listen.
What can I do for you, sir?
Well, sir, it's this rug I have. It really tied the room together.
You told Brandt on the phone. He told me. Where do I fit in?
Well, they were looking for you, these two guys.
Say it again. You told Brandt on the phone. He told me. I know what happened. Yes, yes.
Oh, so you know that they were trying to on your rug.
Did I urinate on your rug?
You mean, did you personally come and on my rug?
Hello. Do you speak English, sir? Parla usted inglés? I'll ask you again. Did I urinate on your rug?
No, like I said, woo, or on my rug.
I just want to understand this, sir. Every time a rug is micturated upon in this fair city, I have to compensate the person?
Come on, man. I'm not trying to scam anybody here. I'm just...
You're just looking for a handout like every other... Are you employed, Mr. Lebowski?
Let me explain something to you. I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. So that's what you call me, you know? His dudeness or duder or, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
Are you employed, sir?
Employed?
You don't go out looking for a job dressed like that, do you? On a weekday?
Is this a... What day is this?
Well, I do work, sir. So if you don't mind...
No, I do mind. The dude minds. This will not stand, you know? This aggression will not stand, man.
It's still funny. And that's our guest, Jeff Bridges, in The Big Lebowski. How did you get the dude?
Well, for one thing, the clothes, Mary Zofries, the costume designer on that film, came over to my house and we said, let's go look in my closet and see if we got anything in there that might be handy. And then, in there we found the dude's jelly shoes, that weird Asian baseball player shirt. The clothes were mine. So that was very helpful. And, when I first heard about The Big Lebowski, it was maybe a year or two before the film, and Joel and Ethan, I saw them somewhere, and they said, "Hey, we're writing something for you." I said,
"It's the
Coen
Brothers, right?"
Because the Coen Brothers, because I was, I'm a big fan of Blood Simple and some of their earlier stuff, And then I got the script, and, you know, I had no memory of any role that I had ever played like that. It felt like they had, you know, gone to some of my high school parties or, you know, I don't know where, you know, where they got, you know, why they were writing that specifically for me. But I guess they were onto something because it did kind of, you know, fit some of my, you know, my MO and my... you know, my characteristics, my hair, my look, you know, that sort of thing.
The film, of course, has this huge following. There are screenings where people show up in character.
Yeah.
Do you ever go to these things? Do you welcome this?
I went to one. I had my Beatle moment at one. I have a band.
The Abiders.
Called the Abiders. Mm-hmm. Some people think that we're the Biters. And us, the Abiders. The Biters is not a bad title for a group. But anyway, the Abiders, we once played a Lebowski Fest. And, you know, I came out, the dude, you know. And you look out there and you're playing to a sea of dudes. They're all dressed up like the dudes or bowling pins or Maud. You know, they all have the different characters.
How did your father feel about your career?
Oh, man, he was so proud when I won the Academy Award. I wished he would have, and he and my mom could have been there because they would have really loved that moment. But, he just, you know, was very proud of both his guys, both his boys.
And I'm sure you were proud of a lot of the stuff he did well into, you know, his later years.
Oh, my dad? Oh, yeah. God. Oh, yeah, incredibly proud of him. I remember doing a movie, Blown Away, and I went to the producer and said, you know, I have a good actor. I know a good actor who could play my uncle. He kind of looks like me, and a wonderful actor, Lloyd Bridges. And the producer said, well, he is a good actor, but he's really more of a comedian. I said, what are you talking about, man? He says, yeah, well, you know, the airplane movies and... And I say, oh, my God, you're going to make him come in and read for the part? And the guy said, would he come in and read? And I say, well, he wants the part. But yeah. So my dad came in. We read together. Of course, he got the part. But that thing of, developing too strong a persona, you know, my dad, you know, early on in his career, he did that Sea Hunt, you know, TV show. And everybody thought he did such a great job. Everybody thought he was a skin diver. So he got a lot of skin diving scripts, you know. And then when he got the comedy thing, they think he's that, you know. So you gotta watch that. I really, early on in my career, I really went about trying, to not develop too strong a persona for that very reason.
Well, Jeff Bridges, it's been fun. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Great hanging with you. Thanks for having me.
Jeff Bridges stars with Ben Foster and Chris Pine in the modern Western Hell or High Water. Now we'll hear from our TV critic David Bianculli. Netflix is premiering the first season of a new TV series version of A Series of Unfortunate Events, the popular children's books written by Daniel Handler under the pen name Lemony Snicket. Jim Carrey starred in a movie version back in 2004, but this is a brand new adaptation, and David adores it. Here's his review.
I don't want to oversell this new version of A Series of Unfortunate Events, but I don't know how not to. Everything that the movie version got wrong, this TV adaptation gets right. And not just right, but brilliantly. The difference is as stark and as significant as the difference between the movie and TV versions of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where the writer of that story, Joss Whedon, took the reins and made a television version much truer to his original vision. Daniel Handler, who wrote the original series of Lemony Snicket books, has done the same thing here. And he's enlisted as his key co-conspirators two pitch-perfect collaborators. Barry Sonnenfeld, of Pushing Daisies and the Addams Family fame, as the director of many of the episodes and an executive producer, and as another producer and the show's central star, Neil Patrick Harris. This new 8-episode Netflix version, which is written by Handler, is inspiringly faithful to the original books, with 2 episodes devoted to each of the first handful of stories. The look, which comes from Sonnenfeld, is full-out fairy tale fright mode, occasionally bright colors against oppressively gray backgrounds, aptly reflecting the mood of the stories. And these are sad, sad stories indeed. The narrative begins with three children being told their parents have died in a fire that burned down the family home, and goes downhill from there. These stories are cracklingly intelligent and delightfully droll, and occasionally, surprisingly, laugh-out-loud funny. They're also so dark, they come with a warning attached. Not just at the start, but throughout. In the books, these warnings are delivered by the alleged author, Lemony Snicket. He delivers the same deadpan warnings in the TV version, too. But for TV, Lemony Snicket appears throughout as a pessimistic gloom-and-doom on-screen narrator, sort of a modern-day cross between Rod Serling and Eeyore. And he's played by Patrick Warburton, whose delivery is as no-nonsense and as inexplicably charming as his disclaimers.
If you are interested in stories with happy endings, then you would be better off somewhere else. In the story, not only is there no happy ending, there is no happy beginning, and very few happy things in the middle. My name is Lemony Snicket. It is my solemn duty to bring to light the sorry history of the Baudelaire children as it happened so many years ago. But you in the audience have no such obligation, and I would advise all our viewers to turn away immediately and watch something more pleasant instead.
While Lemony is urging you not to watch A Series of Unfortunate Events, I'm begging you to. I haven't had this much fun watching TV in quite a while. The three kids playing the unfortunate Baudelaire children, the story's central heroes, are exceptional. Melina Weissman is Violet, the young teenage inventor. Lewis Hines is Klaus, the preteen bookworm. And Presley Smith is Sonny, the expressive baby with very sharp teeth. Their chief nemesis is Count Olaf, an actor and schemer played by Neil Patrick Harris, who adopts several guises and plots in hopes of stealing the family fortune the children eventually will inherit. Different stories and episodes are filled with delightful supporting players and performances. Alfre Woodard, as an easily frightened woman, has her most playful role in decades. Catherine O'Hara, Asif Manvi, Joan Cusack, and others pop in and out, all having heaps of fun playing outrageous characters. No one has more fun, though, or is more outrageous than Neil Patrick Harris. He was a wonderfully camp, cartoonish villain back when he played the titular bad guy in Joss Whedon's Dr. Horrible sing-along blog, but that was only a warm-up for his evil ways in Unfortunate Events. Here he is, threatening the children who have been newly placed in his care, even as he welcomes them to his home, taking them on a tour of its increasingly dismal and gloomy rooms.
Bathroom number 7, the only one you are allowed to use. It has all the usual amenities, though the management regrets to inform you that the shampoo is not tear-free. If anything, it encourages tears. Rats bite. And this is where you will sleep, orphans. Out of all the numerous bedrooms in this enormous mansion, I have chosen this one for your safety and comfort.
There's only one bed.
As you can see, I have provided at no cost to you this complimentary pile of rocks.
I don't know how old children should be to watch this series. That's a call parents should make for themselves. But no one is too old. The tone of this show is utterly charming, and it never falters. It looks great, sounds great, takes maze-like twists and turns, and preserves all the quirky things that made the original book series such a treat. Even the long discourses on proper grammar and the deeply buried clues and puns are here. Neil Patrick Harris even sings the show's theme song, which changes each week to reflect the updated action, but always ends by encouraging viewers to look away. Don't you dare, or you'll be missing one of the best new TV shows in a long time.
Look away, look away, look away, look away. The show will wreck your evening, your whole life and your day. Every single episode is nothing but dismay. So look away, look away, look away.
Three children lose their home and go to...
David Biancooley is editor of the website TV Worth Watching and the author of The Platinum Age of Television. Coming up, sportscaster Joe Buck. He does World Series and Super Bowls and has won 7 Emmy Awards. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Most of us have jobs where we have to behave ourselves. In Joe Buck's job, he gets to yell.
Bases loaded. Two out. Hard hit into right. Back at the wall. Tie game!
Buck is one of the leading play-by-play broadcasters in sports. At the age of 47, he's done 19 World Series and 4 Super Bowls. He'll do his 5th in Houston next month. It's fair to say he grew up in the business. His father, Jack Buck, was a Hall of Fame announcer who also did World Series games. Joe Buck has won 7 Emmy Awards, but he somehow gets more guff from fans on the internet than just about any broadcaster in sports. He's written a new memoir about his experiences in sports and life, including his addiction to hair plug transplants, one of which went south and nearly ruined his career. The book's called Lucky Bastard. The luck refers to the good fortune in Buck's professional career. The other part is about a twist in his personal story you'll soon hear about. I spoke with Joe Buck earlier this week. Well, Joe Buck, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to begin by talking about the craft, what you do, broadcasting live sports. You do radio and television, and you write that television is an act, radio is about being yourself. What do you mean?
Well, I think when you do radio, like what we're doing right now, there is a certain amount of freedom that when you walk in and sit down and turn the mic on, it's you. It's all you. If I sit down in the broadcast booth and I'm doing radio, I can talk about the weather. I can talk about the popcorn vendor. I can talk about the uniforms that the two teams are wearing. I can talk about the size of the crowd, talk about who's up in the bullpen. When I'm doing TV, it's more of a choreographed dance in a way. So I've got to follow the pictures, or the pictures have to follow me. So there's a little bit more of a freedom when you're doing radio play-by-play as opposed to television. I prefer the television side of it. I started in radio. I enjoy the mental gymnastics that go along with matching voice to picture and vice versa, and trying to accent the action as opposed to provide all of the action through my words. And that's really what play-by-play is.
So you can take a minute to think. In television, you don't want to repeat what everyone's saying, but you want to enhance their understanding, their enjoyment of it.
Yeah, I think by its very nature, it's redundant. You know, it being the play-by-play guy on television, the camera is really the play-by-play person. If you're the play-by-play announcer, I think it's your job to be better than just saying what's on people's TV screen. So if there's a ground ball to the right of the shortstop, name the shortstop, Derek Jeter, or in today's game, Francisco Lindor, you can make an editorial comment about the play while it's going on. You don't have to be bogged down by the details because the camera is showing the ground ball to short. So in the midst of that, all you have to say is Lindor to his right, going to be a tough play. Got him at first. As opposed to radio, I don't have time for that. I have to say Lindor takes 3 steps to his right, backhands the ball, comes over the top, long throw, he got him. There's a subtle difference in there. But I think kind of being on the upbeat, or in a musical sense, kind of being off rhythm a little bit is preferable to me as opposed to having to go blow by blow, which is what radio requires.
All right. Now, I want to play a call of yours, which is exactly about this, accentuating what the audience sees, not repeating it. This is from 2008, the National League Championship Series, Phillies versus Dodgers. Our program is broadcast from Philadelphia, so I'm a Phillies fan. I remember watching this game, and It's a home run call, and I'm going to just say two things about what the audience sees, because they're not going to hear this in your call. But what the audience sees is a home run. The batter is Matt Stairs. He's a beefy guy with a compact swing, powerful swing. It's a tense moment. The Phillies are making a comeback in an important game. So we see this compact swing drive the ball out. And then the other thing is, this game is in Dodger Stadium, Chavez Ravine, where the bleachers are relatively small, and you can see the desert in the dark outside. And as the ball flies over the right field fence, you see the ball move from light into shadow. That's what the audience sees. Let's listen to your call.
Stairs rips one into the night, deep into right, way out of here. And Philadelphia gets a pinch hit, two-run shot. And the Phillies lead 7-5 in the eighth.
Now, I've remembered that call for 8 years because it's just a lovely piece of baseball poetry. Stairs rips one into the night as you see the ball disappear into the shadows. You know, writers have time to craft phrases like that. You've got to do it in the moment. Is there a technique? Are there muscles that you develop for coming up with that quick, evocative turn of phrase?
Well, I think the first thing is you have to be prepared. And if you're prepared, you can be relaxed. And I'm not giving you a canned answer. I've never thought about it in these terms, really. But I think if you are ready for a moment like that, and by ready, I mean you've got all the stats of Stairs at your fingertips if you want to go there. You know who's on the mound. You're aware of the game situation. And now you can just sit back and watch. It's when you're ill-prepared and you're on the edge of your seat and you're gripping and you're going, oh my God, where's Stairs stats? And yeah, he is a beefy left-handed hitter, and who's the guy on the mound? And you know, I'm lost in this game, that you don't see that. I remember making that call. I remember that vividly. And it was one of those, it's like a thump, those moments and that swing and that connection and that ball flying off his bat kind of hits you in the chest, and it takes a little bit of your breath away because it's a stunning moment in a really intense game, and so you better be ready for that to happen.
I have to ask about your voice. It's pretty distinctive. It cuts through that crowd noise in a way. Did you work on that? Did people talk about your voice when you were growing up?
Well, I think most people associate me with my dad, and my dad was a Baseball Hall of Fame broadcaster and NFL Hall of Fame broadcaster, had a grovelly voice. He talked like this.
Yeah. No, it's
hey,
different.
How are you?
It's a different voice from yours. I remember your dad. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when I started with the Cardinals, my first year, I was 20, about to turn 21. And I was getting all the nepotism complaints from the local media outlets, from a radio TV critic in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, from the letters to the editor. Can't believe we're subjected to Jack Buck's kid broadcasting these games. And every time you see kid and hear kid, you think, man, I have to not sound like a kid. And so I went from talking up here, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the ballpark. It's a great day for a game, to trying to consciously get my voice down here and say, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to. And I started to change my voice. And I went from, you know, sounding like I was going through puberty on the air to really sounding like a man.
You, in the book, name some other sports broadcasters that you admire, Mike Tirico, Al Michaels. You choose not to name people you don't think are so good. But I'm curious, what bothers you in an announcer that you feel isn't measuring up?
Over-talking, doing too much, trying to prove to the audience that they did their reading. Trying to make the call about themselves. The way I've always done it, right, wrong, good, bad, whatever anybody's opinion may be, is let's take the Cubs winning the World Series for the first time in 108 years this past October. I could choose to make that call all about me, screaming and yelling and, you know, ground ball to Chris Bryant, going to be a tough play, out at first, and for the first time in 108 years, the Chicago Cubs have finally won it all. They gather on the mound, players jumping over. I don't want to say all that stuff. I just want to state what happened. I want to do it in an exciting way. I haven't always accomplished that, by the way. And I want to get out of the viewer's head. It's not about me. Nobody's tuning in. Let's check the TV guide listings and see what game Joe Buck is calling. Nobody cares. They want to see the Cubs. They want to see the Packers. They want to see the Cowboys. So I've joked that if I get hit by a bus going into a game, they're still going to play. And the guys that bother me, without naming names, are the guys who sound like if they got hit by that bus, the game would be canceled. And that's annoying.
You grew up in broadcasting. Your dad was Jack Buck, Hall of Fame broadcaster. And he was the play-by-play guy for the St. Louis Cardinals. St. Louis is a huge baseball town. And anybody who follows the game knows that the play-by-play guy for a baseball team is a major celebrity in a city. You're probably better known and loved than the mayor. You had quite a bit of exposure to this life as a kid, didn't you? What was it like? You had the run of the stadium?
Oh, I did. Yeah, the stadium was my playground. And I was down there with my dad night after night, not just in the summer, but even school nights. And sometimes school nights led to late mornings, led to late arrival at school. Baseball and Busch Stadium, I guess for lack of a better term, it was my little romper room. And so by that, I mean, I was in the broadcast booth during the game. If I got bored up there when I was a little kid, I'd run down underneath by the dugouts on the inside part of the ballpark, and other players' kids would be throwing a tennis ball around, and we'd be throwing it at each other. And I had run of the place. That was my spot. Every day after school or during the summer, I'd ride down with my dad at 3 o'clock. And then as I got a little bit older, I'd broadcast at least do games into a tape recorder. He and I would listen to the tape on the way home. It was just a great way to grow up, and I guess without knowing it, I was aiming myself for a life in sports and in baseball in particular.
You write in the book that once a month, your dad would drive over to a house. He would bring you with him, drive over to a house, and deliver a check to another family. Explain what was going on here.
Well, he was divorced. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't understand all that. You know, it's why my book is titled what it is, which is probably not politically correct, or maybe.
Well, we can say the name here. It's Lucky Bastard, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's because I guess in a way that's exactly what I am. First of all, I'm the luckiest guy in the world to be my parents' son and to be Jack Buck's son, but Carol Buck's son as well. And then I came onto the earth as a result of my dad meeting my mom while my dad was married with 6 kids. And he and my mom ended up getting married a month before I was born. So he had this other family. And when I was old enough to move around, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, there were times where I would go with him to deliver a check to this woman and this house filled with 6 other kids. I knew I wasn't wanted there. And as time went on, I knew that I represented something really painful in their lives by being, I guess, the direct result of why their dad left their mom. And so to this day, I'm not sure why I went on those trips over to his other house, so to speak.
Why he brought you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why he brought me. Maybe because he knew it wouldn't get out of hand or real nasty if the kid was there. Because it was tense, and I think without knowing it, I was learning a lot about relationships and about heartbreak and about, you know, in this case, kids who were looking up to a man who, I guess, in a very simple sense, let them down.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Joe Buck. He is a play-by-play broadcaster for Fox Sports, and he has a new memoir. You got into broadcasting at a high level at an early age. You did St. Louis Cardinals broadcasts with your dad for what? Part of 11 seasons, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to even remember that on one hand. And then on the other, I look back on that as the, in some ways, highlight of my career. Because my dad, who literally was kind of my buddy more than my father, and really my best friend more than the guy who would come home having to discipline us or the 9-to-5 guy. He was He was gone for different stretches of time and was on a road trip with the Cardinals. And then when that would bleed into football, he was into that. And then he was doing a radio show in St. Louis. There was a lot of time that I gave up with my dad. So consequently, when he and I were together, I didn't want to waste that time with him having to discipline me. And so I acted the right way as a little kid. And we had the best possible, I think, father-son relationship that we could have. And then when we were paired together and I was on all those buses and I was on all those road trips with him and I was getting on the team charter and I was, you know, riding home from the airport at 2 o'clock in the morning after a road trip to Houston, I got a lot of that time back. And so whether it's my half brothers and sisters or my full sister, Julie, I saw him in a different way.
Last summer, I played golf. I know you like to play golf. And I got teamed up with a father and son. And the son, who was in his 20s, works at Fox Sports. And I mentioned that I might be talking to you about the book. And he said, yeah, a lot of people can't stand Joe Buck. And I said, well, why? Is he a jerk? And he said, no, he's a good guy. But just a lot of people don't like him. And when I looked at the internet, I discovered there is this bunch of people that don't like you. There's an I Hate Joe Buck fan club on Facebook. One guy writes, I wonder how many times Joe Buck looks at himself in the mirror and winks. Somebody says, an arrogant ass who thinks he's a celebrity, always rooting for San Francisco in the World Series. What's this about? What?
that particular one is unbelievable. If you go, you should walk the streets with me in San Francisco and see the looks I get. And this answers the question. If it wasn't me doing what I do, and it was somebody else, the same thing would be said. When you do the World Series and you show up at the most important time of the year and you've got baseball fans on either side who have listened to their announcers all season long, who do the game from their perspective, who have the same rooting interest as the fans they talk to, and now when it matters most, here comes the national guy who doesn't represent them. He doesn't represent the other side. And so consequently, each side thinks I'm for the other because they don't hear games done that way all year. Oh, sure, they'll hear somebody scream and yell for a Pablo Sandoval home run for the San Francisco Giants back in the day. And they're used to that. But they're not used to then me turning around and yelling and screaming for a home run by Miguel Cabrera. So it hits their ear funny. That's not what they hear all year long. They want to hear their guys do their games. And I represent somebody who has a rooting interest for neither side. And it's kind of like being trapped in the middle there. And so that's where that comes from. I don't take it personally. And I know that whenever I'm finished, whoever steps into that seat, it may not happen right away. But after a while, people are going to go, well, this guy sucks too. Where's that other guy? He doesn't like my team either. Well, what's going on? It's just that the fans care so much that if you're not in their camp, you're in their mind against them. And it's a tough way to be if you let that stuff bother you.
Well, Joe Buck, it's been fun. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, man, what a joy. Thanks for having me on.
Joe Buck is a play-by-play announcer for Fox Sports. His new memoir is called Lucky Bastard. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, and Mooj Zaidi. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.